I don't see Deborah as a prefigure of Mary. There's no reason to think that. Unless, of course, you're a Catholic. You want to make... I mentioned... Please. Help my voice here. Remember I mentioned there are many prefigures of Jesus. In order to be a prefigure of Jesus, you either need to be a prophet, a priest, or a king, or a prince. All right, you need to save Israel. And Deborah is a prefigure of the Messiah, and Esther is a prefigure of the Messiah. They both were... Esther was a queen. But to me, there's a fancy word for this, all right? Exegesis is reading the meaning from the Scriptures, and eisegesis is reading meaning into the Scriptures. That's a bad thing to do. And we've been guilty of that ourselves at times, I'm sure. All right, so there's... I just don't see any parallels at all. I mean, you have to have some parallels. All right, so the only way to make it be a parallel is to make Mary something that she's not, and then say there's a parallel, which doesn't even make sense. So the follow-up question is, how would you respond to someone who thinks that Mary is a co-redeemer with Christ? That is so leave her as she is an amazingly faithful young woman. But to have her be co-redeemer, because only God could be that sacrifice. And so that would be to lift Mary up to being God. And if you asked Mary for permission, she would, I don't know what she would do. She would be so to see Mary lifted up. The historical reason for this is the Catholic Church over time made Jesus less human, less relatable, more distant up on this cross. And, you know, I guess it's not wrong to have an image of Jesus on the cross, I guess. That's kind of a bizarre thing for a Christian to spend time looking at, because for us, Jesus is not on the cross anymore. So as there. By the way, it was in the they began to call her Theotokos, which is basically Mother of God, God-bearer. The reason they did that was they were trying to settle a dispute about Jesus. Because some people said that Jesus was not fully human. Others people said he was not fully God. They were trying to say that Jesus was God from the time of his birth, not that he sort of assumed that role after his baptism. They called Mary Mother of God, even talking about Mary. They're talking about Jesus. So it was like Mary, Mother of God. And then only a couple hundred years later was it Mary, Mother of God. And so that's the history there. Okay. Now let's get back to our archaeology here. We got some pretty great stuff. Again, we should expect to be able to find archaeological evidence, not to prove everything, archaeological evidence to prove that David killed Goliath. I mean, what would you find? I believe David killed Goliath. I believe that for a few reasons. One, because I believe the Bible is inspired by God. But even from a historical perspective, because the Bible is historical accurately, whenever we can test it, it seems reasonable to infer that it's also accurate. We can't. That's just common sense to me. So anyway, we have the Moabite stone, sometimes called the Misha Stela, from 870 B.C. And it mentions Ahab of the house of Omri. So here we have clear physical evidence that Ahab existed, but that Omri was the first of a line of kings in the northern kingdom, which confirms information in 1 Kings 16, verse 28. Then there's the Tel Dan inscription, one of my favorites. A good friend of mine is John Wilson. He's an archaeologist, professor at Pepperdine University for many, many years. And he tells the story. He was actually in the city of Dan the very day this was discovered. In fact, he walked by the place there it was that morning, but the sun was at the wrong angle. What ancient peoples would do, they would destroy a city. Then they take the stones from the rubble and rebuild the next layer of city. So this was basically a piece of rubble found in the wall, but there's an archaeologist walking by right at sunset so that these words were lit up. Okay, got it? And this comes from Dan. The city of Dan is the northernmost city. It's actually northeast of the Sea of Galilee on the border with Syria. At that time, it was called Aram. This is an inscription by the king of Aram. And here's what he says. He boasts, "I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David." Well, that's kind of cool. So what does this tell us? It tells us, in a southern kingdom, at this time, 820 BC, the southern kingdom was ruled by a dynasty, the first of whom was this king we know of as David. Dramatic evidence that not only that David existed, but that he was a king of the southern kingdom, that he was the first of a line of kings. Now, you and I go, well, obviously it's in the Bible. Okay, fine. Now, here's the interesting thing. Our friend, Hatzael, boasts that he killed Joram. But it turns out that's not true. According to 2 Kings 8:29, Joram was wounded in the battle. And later he was killed by Jehu. Now, you have two accounts. One that says both killed in the battle. The other one says one was killed, the other one was wounded, and was later killed by Jehu. Now let me ask you a very simple common sense question. Which is the more reliable account? Answer is, obviously the biblical account is more reliable, because it fully agrees with the other one, it just adds another detail. And people you'd think would notice this after a while, they seem to never notice. Here's the black obelisk of Shalmaneser. Now, one of the things is, there are no statues and engravings in Canaan of any of these leaders. That's kind of frustrating. Why not? Because the Bible said not to make them. And the Jews, they didn't obey too many of the laws, you know. But that seems to be one law. They didn't make statues. So if you want to find an engraving or a statue or a drawing of one of Judah's or Israel's leaders, you have to go outside of Israel. And sure enough, you have this thing. It's in the British Museum. All right? It's about this tall or so. It's got several little things. Basically, it's the story of this campaign of Shalmaneser to conquer all these people. And according to the inscription, this picture, see that guy bowing? There's a blow-up of that. This is King Jehu. And he's bowing down to King Shalmaneser. Now this is occurring in Iraq, the city, not Babylon, the one that Jonah went to, Nineveh. Sorry, my brain's not working too well. All right, now the Bible does not record Jehu going and bowing before the king. But what it does do is tell him giving tribute. In fact, for all we know, this is sort of symbolic representation of him bowing to the king. Or maybe it actually happened. But it's certainly consistent with the biblical statement, all right, which is that he did indeed submit. All right, great. Now here's another one, the Sennacherib cylinder. This is awesome. It's a hexagonal cylinder. It's a beautiful object, really. It's only about this big. It looks huge, but it's only about this big. The writing is tiny. It's there in the British Museum. All right, now here's what it says about King Hezekiah. It says, "As to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to the countless small villages in their vicinity. I drove out of them over 200,000 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small, cattle, beyond counting. I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage." So basically what he says is, I conquered all of Judah, and then I put Jerusalem under siege. Story stops there. Why does it stop there? Well, because actually that was the end of his campaign. He went back to Nineveh and he was killed in a palace coup shortly afterward. Now, what's the Bible describe? Same thing. Same person. Same destruction. Same conquerors of all the cities except Jerusalem. It also says what happened to his army. That very night, the angel of the Lord struck down the army. You know, it's interesting. The most powerful army in the world put Jerusalem under siege. And then ends the story. And we know why. Because his army was destroyed. Now, is this inscription proof that the angel destroyed his army? Well, it's evidence. It's consistent. I believe in this case we have some indirect evidence of this miraculous event. Please don't call it proof that the miracle happened, but let's say we have information which is clearly consistent with that. That's sort of cool. All right? And then there's the Siloam inscription. In 2 Kings 20, 21 through 20 through 21, says, "Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah, all his might, and how he made a pool, the Pool of Siloam, we call it, and a tunnel that brought water into the city." So the Bible describes this tunnel that was built. The tunnel was built because they were aware that the Assyrians were coming. They wanted to gain access to the water quite distant from the city. All right, so they dug this very, very long tunnel. Well, guess what? The tunnel was discovered. And this here is the Siloam inscription, which describes the building of the tunnel. How they started from the city and from the spring of Gihon, and then they met in the middle, 900 feet from each direction, amassing feet of engineering. And this inscription is at the place where the two excavations met. So you know what? I think probably Hezekiah was a real person. I think that probably the Assyrian king did attack, did put him under siege, and I believe that Hezekiah really did build this tunnel. All right? And I believe also that the armies of the Assyrians were destroyed by the destroying angel, which is certainly consistent. Okay, that's kind of cool. Also, at the time, actually, just a few years before, Sennacherib attacked the northern kingdom. And the book of 2 Kings describes the destruction of Lachish. Now, it's a little bit confusing because Lachish was destroyed two different times. Lachish was destroyed by the Assyrians and then was destroyed later on by the Babylonians. If you go to the British Museum, there's an entire room filled with inscriptions, which are drawings found from Nineveh, of this amazing epic battle and the destruction of Lachish, as described both by the Syrians and in the Bible. And here you see Jews, and you can tell they're Jews by their beards. You can see them being taken off into captivity. You can see them being flayed alive. So they would pin them down at the foot of the city and take their skin off right in front of the people inside the city. All right? Those are all taken from that event. And then here's the Babylonian Chronicles. Now remember, Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem three different times. First in 605 BC. At that point, there was no battle, as far as we know. At that point, the Jews, Jehoiakim, just basically submitted. He took captives, including Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego at that time, held them as hostages. Then he came back in 597 BC. They had rebelled at that point. He got them to submit. He tore down part of the wall, and he took the king. And I can't remember, Ezekiel, 5,000 of the cream of the crop. All right, and that would include Ezekiel, by the way. So here we have the Babylonian Chronicles. In the seventh year, the month of Kislev, the king of Babylonia must, this is written by the Babylonians, okay, mustered his forces and marched to Syria. He camped against the city of Judah, Jerusalem. And on the second day of the month of Adar, he took the city and he captured the king. That's Jehoiachin. He appointed a king in his place. We know his name. His name is Zedekiah. And he took heavy tribute and brought them to Babylon. Again, in agreement with the biblical account. Now, this is one of the Lachish letters. This comes from the third. It was a long siege, 588 through 586, a two-year siege of Jerusalem, as prophesied in detail by Ezekiel. That's some great stuff. Now, if you read in Jeremiah, it talks about this. It's a really sad situation. All right? If you read Jeremiah 52, 1 through 28, it says the only set of cities left were Lachish and Azekah. All right? And by the way, this ostraca is a clay shard which they would write on, usually with charcoal. And these are found, of course, in the British Museum. And there's one writing on this thing. And it says this. It says, the light at the top of Azekah just went out. And we're next. The person who wrote this inscription probably died within just days of writing it, because we know what happened. You can see the ruin of Lachish, which was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. And it's interesting, the biblical account says first Azekah, then Lachish, then Jerusalem. Here we go. First Azekah, then Lachish, then Jerusalem. Again, as Christians, we go, well, yeah, okay, it's what it says, then it's what happened. But we have dramatic proof of this very specific detail, not just a general thing. Okay, there are some more Lachish letters. Here's a cool one. Now, the Bible describes an interesting thing. It says in it's Jeremiah. I believe at the end of Jeremiah, it says that Nebuchadnezzar took Jehoiachin to Babylon and treated him as a king and gave him special honor as a Jew. Well, that's weird. Why would he do that? Seems unbelievable. But they found in the wall in destruction of Babylon a list of provisions given to people in the city. And guess who's mentioned here? The person who's mentioned is Jehoiachin. And it calls him Yaukin. Instead of Jehoiachin, it calls him Yaukin. And he got something like 5 times the amount of provisions of all the other people in the list. That's sort of cool. I mean, apparently, yes, it is true that he was taken to Babylon. Yes, it is true that he was given extra provisions and treated as a king. That's kind of cool. All right, here's one of my favorite. Now, I already showed you this slide. There's a reason for that. In Daniel chapter 5, it describes the destruction of Babylon. It's the writing on the wall. If you go to that story, it mentions this guy Belshazzar. And according to the Bible, Belshazzar was the last king of the Babylonians. The problem with this is Herodotus said, no, that's not true. Nabonidus was the last king. Several other historians said, with authority, that Nabonidus was the last king. So obviously, Daniel is just a fable. Nobody could believe it. You know, Daniel wasn't thrown into a lion's den. You know, this is just a story. All right? And so everybody agreed that the Bible was wrong and that history was right and Herodotus was right. Well, guess what? Herodotus was wrong. They found an inscription in the ziggurat in Ur, not in Babylon, because Babylon was destroyed, and basically explains what happened. See, Nabonidus had a palace coup, and he killed evil Merodach, who was the son of Nebuchadnezzar, but he was not legitimate ruler. So what he did was he married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, so his son, whose name was Belshazzar, was legitimate heir. So what he did was he set him up as a regent. Got it? And Nabonidus was rarely even in Babylon. He was off in Sin, literally. There's a city called Sin in the desert. He was into mysticism. He went into Sin. That's kind of a funny thing. But anyway, so if you read Daniel chapter 5, Nabonidus says, if anyone can interpret the writing on the wall, I will give them the third place in the kingdom. Well, why the third place in the kingdom? Because he occupied the second place in the kingdom. Oh, interesting. Daniel has this interesting detail that doesn't even seem to make sense, which people thought contradicted with the known information. But then when you find the inscription, you find out not only is the detail true, it even makes sense. Now, Daniel said, you know, you can keep your third place in the kingdom. You know, I don't really want that. Which probably is a good idea, because that very night that inscription, that the writing appeared on the wall, that very night, Belshazzar was killed. And Herodotus records that. The details that Herodotus records of how they entered the city. In fact, when the scene in Daniel 5 took place, it's likely that Cyrus's armies had already entered the city, which is kind of cool. Not so cool for Belshazzar, though. Now, here's the Cyrus cylinder. In Ezra 1, 2 through 5, there's this amazing statement. Basically, it has Cyrus saying, hey, look, everybody, I want to support you. Go back to your mother countries and rebuild your temples. What ancient ruler ever said to conquered people, hey, I'm going to send you back to your home place, and I want you to reestablish your religion and your worship. I'm going to treat you super nice. mean, that never happened. But the Bible said it happened. And then you can find this Cyrus cylinder, which, by the way, is in the British Museum. And it's big. It's kind of cool. And Cyrus says in this cylinder, I return those sacred cities on the other side of the Tigris, the sanctuaries of which have been in ruins for a long time, the images which used to live therein, and establish them for permanent sanctuaries. Okay, good. All right, now, I'm going to summarize for the Old Testament. The Old Testament is by far the most accurate historical document from the ancient world. And every single time we find a new discovery, it is either consistent with or confirms biblical statements. Never, ever have we found any archaeological discovery or historical writing that contradicted anything that's recorded in the Bible. All right? So this is evidence. One of the additional evidence that the Bible is inspired is from history. Now, we can talk about the New Testament. I don't want to spend too much time here. I want to get on to our next topic. But again, people would say that these are stories made up. Luke is just making up this stuff. And, you know, you can't believe much of any of it. You know, these were all written 100 years later, 150 AD, 100 AD. Well, then when they started to find manuscripts, they kind of backed off on that and they admitted, well, you know, yeah, maybe they were written in the first century, but really, none of these things really happened. There was no such thing as Pontius Pilate because Rome had no record of a procurator of Judea named Pontius Pilate. So obviously, there was no Pontius Pilate. And then in Caesarea Maritima, they found this inscription, which sure enough tells us that Pontius Pilate was prefect of Judea under Tiberius. As far as crucifixion, this is an actual ankle, actually a pair of ankles, with a nail through it. This is not Jesus, of course, right? They're not going to find Jesus' body anywhere. All right? Pool of Siloam. This is the ossuary of Caiaphas, who was the high priest. He's mentioned right there in Acts. The actual ossuary, bone box, of Caiaphas, the son of Joseph. I think they're real people. This was found in the temple, an inscription called Corban. Remember they talked about Corban? And let you know, because I gave her Corban, I don't have to give my parents anything. And there's an inscription. And basically this item was Corban. All right. Now, William Ramsey, who was perhaps the greatest archaeologist of his day, he was a total skeptic. He agreed with everybody else. These are unreliable accounts by people who had no training. And so he went to the Middle East and he became the leading archaeologist of Middle East in the time. This is in the 1920s and 30s. And he reached the conclusion that Luke is an amazing historian. The accuracy, Luke lists something like 13 different titles. There's tetrarchs and dectarchs and consuls and proconsuls and procurators and all these things. Every single time when Luke gave the title for somebody, he got it right. There's one place where Cicero called somebody something and Luke called him something else. They found an inscription. Guess who's right, Cicero or Luke? Luke is always right. All right? And so Ramsey calls him a historian. Now, I mean, he was a professional quality historian. So when he collects his accounts, he's doing it as a professional historian. So we have Sergius Paulus. Yes, he was an actual person. And this one in chapter 17:6 mentions the name Politarch. Now, Politarch was a political name that was not found anywhere from the ancient world except in Luke. Luke was the only writer who ever mentioned this title, Politarch. And then they found an inscription in Thessalonica which says the leaders were Politarchs. All right? So again, I would say this. Not only would I say the Old Testament is the most reliable historical document from that period, I would say the New Testament as well is extremely reliable. Gallio, in Delphi, here's this guy Erastus from Corinth. All right. Here's a thing talking about if you go into the temple, they'll kill you. Here's Felix, the governor who put Paul on trial. All right. Good. So that was a shorter session. I could start the next session for 15 minutes. That was only half an hour. So we're going to take a 10-minute break, but the next session is probably going to go about an hour and 10, hour and 15 minutes, okay? So it's kind of quick. Let's make about a 6-minute break.